What's up, Daily Real Estate Investor folks? We are back for another episode, and I'm happy to be with you today. I'm your host, Josiah Smelser, and today we're going to run through some trending things in the real estate markets right now that I think you will find interesting, all right? We're going to cover some news topics. The first thing I wanted to talk about is an article on Fox Business I thought you'd find interesting, and it's titled Shark Tank Star Warns Real Estate Doom Loop Has Not Improved. The commercial real estate collapse is expected to bring investors and small businesses more economic woes. Now, this is Mr. Wonderful, Kevin O'Leary, and he's ringing in on what's going on in the real estate markets. So I'm going to read some of this to you, and I'll share my thoughts on it as well. The commercial real estate industry is on the brink of collapse, according to one Shark Tank star. O'Leary Ventures CEO Kevin O'Leary explained that the doom loop facing commercial real estate has not improved. What's unique about this situation, and I'll just lay it out, many of these are office spaces that are in subgrade markets. But even in cities like Boston, you'll find lots of vacancies, you know, up to 40% of buildings, O'Leary said. In cities across the nation, office buildings in particular have been largely vacant since COVID lockdowns, with companies relying more on remote work or hybrid models. The demand for office space has only continued to shrink since 2020. So I have been pounding the table on avoiding office space for quite a while, but man, am I glad that I did not invest heavily into commercial office space in these big cities, because it is not looking good. Okay, so back to our article. A study published by McKinsey in July examined real estate in 9 superstar cities. These cities are San Francisco, New York, Houston, London, Paris, Munich, Tokyo, Beijing, Shanghai. And this study estimated that office attendance is currently about 30% lower than the typical pre-pandemic level seen in 2019. So, fundamental shift in our market on demand for office, and it's down 30%. That is a lot. So this says demand may stir back to life in coming years, but the consulting firm projected that attendance will still be 13% lower in 2030 compared to before the pandemic began. The massive decline in demand will ultimately drive down property value. On the average, the total of office space in the 9 cities could plummet by 26% from 2019 to 2030. Or a decline of roughly $800 billion. Most of these cannot be used again. Hold on. Most of these cannot be used again as offices because the economy has changed. No one saw this coming, but up to 40% of people that work in small businesses don't return to offices anymore. So we have to repurpose this. You have to take an old office and turn it into a climate-controlled storage unit or a condominium. But in cities like New York, where it's decimated in those double buildings, they're just empty. You can't do that without the zoning changes, and policy there is very difficult. So that's going to wrap up article number one. But the commercial real estate doom loop in specifically office is a real thing, and it is not getting better anytime soon. Yes, there are more people returning to the office slowly right now, but there's so much vacancy, and when there's a lot of vacancy, people lower their rates, landlords lower their rates to try to get those spaces leased up. And as you know, commercial real estate is valued based on the income and the market cap rate. Well, at the same time as occupancy has fallen through the floor, we've got interest rates going through the roof. So this is getting squeezed from both sides because cash flow is getting squeezed from lower occupancy. And also, as these things are refinanced, the rates are going way up. So this is a bad deal. So office space is suffering right now. All right, let's move on to an interesting story here, a little bit different flavor for you. This one's on Yahoo Finance. I thought this was interesting. I think you will too. Whether you love or hate Donald Trump is irrelevant. This is an interesting story. Donald Trump made billions in real estate, but his dad was the one who built a billion-dollar empire from scratch. Learn their strategies and start investing the way they did. All right, let's look into this article a little bit. Some of this stuff's really, really pretty interesting to see how the Trump family made it in real estate. So before he became a controversial former president, Donald Trump was widely recognized for the wealth he gained in the real estate industry. But the story behind his billions is more intricate than it may appear. The Trump family's journey into real estate success began with Trump's father, Fred Trump. Fred Trump entered the construction business during a significant era in American history, the time of FDR, which aimed to boost residential construction through accessible loans and government support. Fred Trump capitalized on these opportunities, accumulating substantial wealth. One of his major achievements was securing a $26 million loan from the FHA in 1949 to fund the construction of the Shorehaven and Beachhaven residential complexes in Brooklyn, New York. What sets the Trump family story apart is their approach to transferring wealth strategically. That's the key here. Strategic transferring of wealth. This is where Fred Trump knocked it out of the park. Like, this guy is a savvy cat. All right. Fred Trump employed clever methods to ensure the financial well-being of his children, including young Donald Trump, by acquiring land through his corporation, setting up trust with his children as beneficiaries, and he endowed the land to these trusts. This created a consistent income stream for his offspring while effectively navigating around hefty gift taxes. So Fred acquired the Steeplechase Park in Coney Island on July 1st, 1965 for $2.3 million with a plan to develop luxury apartments. So enter Donald Trump. Donald Trump joined the family business in 1968, marking a key moment in the wealth transfer process. 1972, father and son formed a partnership to secure an $8 million loan for the construction of Prospect Tower. So Donald partnered up with Fred, father-son partnership. Despite Fred Trump's significant involvement in the project, it was Donald who reaped the majority of the profits, including consultancy fees, management fees, and tenant revenue. As Donald Trump began his journey through the real estate world, his wealth continued to grow, reaching $9 million by the time he turned 30. But it wasn't just about wealth transfer, it was also about shaping a public image. By 1976, some estimates claimed his net worth was $200 million. Trump became president of the Trump Organization with a substantial salary and steady flow of loans from his father. 1979, Trump received $3 million in loans from his father's companies, structured to allow him to keep the funds indefinitely. The loans multiplied when Donald ventured into his first Manhattan project, transferring the Commodore Hotel into the Grand Hyatt between 1979 and 1980. Trump's trajectory in the real estate industry remained steadfast throughout the 1980s. It was marked by high-profile acquisitions like the Plaza Hotel and the Eastern Airlines Trump Shuttle. Fred Trump, Donald's father, employed various techniques for transferring wealth to his offspring, including purchasing stakes in his son's real estate ventures and selling them back at a loss. In 1992, he established a maintenance company through which millions were funneled for property repairs and enhancements. So as Fred Trump's health declined in the early 1990s, he intensified efforts to pass the remaining wealth to his children, skillfully circumventing estate taxes. I personally don't know what I think about the word circumventing right there. That seems like a little bit of a liberal word. I think a more appropriate word would be, this is a savvy move. he's not doing anything illegal. He's using the tax code and using his CPA's knowledge of the tax code to pay the taxes that he owes, but save as much as he can, which we all want to do, right? I mean, regardless of how you vote, you want to pay your fair share of taxes, but you don't want to pay more than your fair share. And if the tax code is written a certain way, allowing you to maximize your tax savings through real estate write-offs, you're going to do that. I mean, who wants to give more money away in taxes than they have to? So back to the article. By 1999, each of Fred Trump's children were reaping $2.2 million annually from these intricate wealth transfer processes. Upon Fred Trump's death in 1999, his real estate holdings passed into the hands of his children, solidifying his enduring legacy. In 2004, they sold the portfolio to a New York City real estate investor for $700 million. All right, so here's some tips for the investors out there. Start small. If you're new to real estate investing, begin with a manageable property that you can oversee. Tip number two, location matters. Choose properties in areas with good growth potential. Side note for me, this is what made all the difference in my own investing experience. I chose properties in Fort Worth, Texas, where I had a good feeling that things were going to do really, really well based on the data I had, and they did exceptionally well. So that made all the difference for me. Okay, tip number three from this article, consider investing in rental properties for consistent income streams. That's what the Trumps did. They bought properties producing income, and you see how it worked out for them. Now, I would say tip number four, keep an eye on interest rates and consider refinancing when rates are lower. And then I would say tip number five, they don't have this in here because it seems like the writer was a little bit on them for their tax planning strategies. But I'd say tip number five, plan to try to save money on your taxes using a wise real estate CPA. Maximize your tax savings and reinvest that money back into your business. All right, that's that article. Let's move on to article number three. All right, we're going to move over to Airbnb, everybody's favorite subject right now. This article's on wired.com. The article is titled, This is the true scale of New York's Airbnb apocalypse. A law meant to crack down on short-term rentals in New York City took effect Tuesday. Thousands have dropped off the map, but there are still hosts offering bookings that may break the law. So this is crazy. I talked about this in a short on our channel, which, by the way, you need to be over joining us on YouTube, as we got shorts coming out daily over there, as well as evergreen topics. Take a second, jump over to YouTube, hit subscribe on the YouTube channel, because we want you to be able to have the full value that we're trying to give here to help you reach financial freedom through real estate investing. All right. But I talked about this over there. New York City just cracked down on Airbnbs, and they came out with a new rule that is requiring the hosts be on the same premises as their Airbnb. So you can imagine how many people this affects, because the average Airbnb host, including myself, does not live where they're live on site with their properties, right? And then I read in one article that the law is also requiring that the Airbnbs have no more than two guests in them. So that's also going to massively affect the number of Airbnb properties rented, because, as you know, lots of families and groups have more than two people wanting to rent. So it seems like this is a massive, massive ordeal. And Airbnb is claiming that the hotels are in cahoots with the city, and this is the city trying to, you know, pander to the hotels there. But let's see what this article has to say. The number of short-term Airbnbs available in New York City has dropped 70% after the city began enforcing a new law requiring short-term rental operators to register their homes. Despite the new requirements, there are still thousands of listings that could be unregistered. The drop recorded between August 4th and September 5th, the day New York City began enforcing the law, represents the disappearance of 15,000 short-term listings from Airbnb. 15,000 in New York. 15,000. That is insane. The figures are based on the data provided by Inside Airbnb, housing advocacy group that tracks listings on the platform. In August, there were 22,000 short-term listings on Airbnb in New York City. As of September 5th, there were 6,841. We went from 22,000 to 6,841 listings in New York City. It seems some of the short-term listings have been switched to long-term listings, which can only be booked for 30 days or more. The number of long-term rentals jumped by about 11,000. And these long-term listings do not need to be registered under the new law. It says, additionally, Inside Airbnb estimates that around 4,000 rentals in total have disappeared from Airbnb since the law took effect. 4,000 rentals have disappeared. This uptick in long-term rentals may show that the law is working by pushing hosts to offer apartments to those staying in New York City for 30 days or more. As if somebody wanting to rent an Airbnb wants a 30-day or more solution. It's just stupid. And it's also so stupid that the New York City government thinks that this is in the best interest of the consumer. It's asinine to me that when the market shows you that there is a demand for something like Airbnb, there's a demand for a reason. The market is telling you they want this for a reason, right? Why do people want to stay in an Airbnb? They want to stay in an Airbnb typically because it's their own place, right? It's a place away from others. They don't have to go into a hotel, stay with a bunch of people they don't know, and they can have a more customizable experience, right? They can rent a place they really like. They have certain amenities they want, like maybe a hot tub or a movie theater, a swimming pool, whatever it is. And it's their place. So there is a demand in the market for this. New York City is basically saying, we're going to tamper with that. We're going to mess with that. And we're going to push you towards these hotels. So what's actually going to happen? Well, I'll tell you what's going to happen for my family. I don't want to go up to New York City and stay in a hotel the whole time. So I know I'm not the only one. So what's this going to do? This is going to decrease the amount of vacation traffic to New York City. Now, you might argue, well, how much is that going to hurt them? Probably not a lot, but it's not a pro-business move here, I don't think. It's a pro-big business move. They're protecting these hotels, but a lot of these hotels really don't need to be in business. They don't provide as good of a service as a lot of Airbnbs do. So that's my opinion here, but I'm in favor of the Airbnb owners here. I think this is a bad move by New York City. So back to the article. At a glance, it's impossible to tell if a listing on Airbnb is registered with the city. Inside Airbnb found that only 28 short-term rentals in New York mentioned having a registration number from the city. It's not immediately clear if those numbers are legitimate, and the number of short-term rentals Inside Airbnb found far outpaces the number the city has registered. Ultimately, hosts will need to display registration numbers on their listings. Man, I mean, what are we doing here? You know, it just seems like they're just making life miserable for these Airbnb owners. And why? Because somebody got on some news channel and said that Airbnb is the reason there's a housing shortage. That is the biggest crock ever. Like, Airbnb has nothing to do with the housing shortage. I saw an article the other day with the number of Airbnbs there are, and it's like less than 1% of the housing market. And they're saying that the housing shortage is because of Airbnbs. That's the most misguided, misdirected thing ever. You want to know why there's a housing shortage? There's a housing shortage because people have a 3.5% interest rate locked in on their primary residence, and the market rate right now is over 7%. Who wants to sell their primary residence at 3.5% and go move into something that's a smaller house for less money on the purchase price and have a mortgage that's higher than where they currently live? the housing market has been frozen by the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes. This is why there's a housing crisis. And why do they have to raise interest rates so much? Because they did too much stimulus. They handed out free money and everybody bought as many real estate properties as they could. So it drove the market way up. This is a problem that was created by the monetary policy in this country. It has nothing to do with the Airbnbs. It's crazy to me that people would even think that's the problem. And you can disagree with me on this, but I'm holding on to my position on this. I do believe this is why the housing market is the way it is. So Airbnb says it began blocking a new short-term reservation. It began blocking new short-term reservations for unregistered rentals as early as August 14th, but did not automatically cancel stays in unregistered apartments before December 1st to avoid disrupting guests' travel plans. Boy, that's got to be exciting as an Airbnb host, seeing that you have a reservation request and then seeing that Airbnb is blocking it, or that you had reservations 3 months out and that since December 1st, they're actually canceling them. Insanity. Like, what are we looking at here? This is so crazy. It says Airbnb's fought against the New York City regulations, saying the change would seriously hamper both its business and host income in the city. To register short-term rental hosts, whether on Airbnb, VRBO, or elsewhere, they must meet a strict set of conditions. They cannot rent out entire apartments. The host must be living in the home and be present during the booking, and only two guests can stay at a time. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of in my life. You can't rent out the entire apartment. The host has to be there. So who wants to rent a place where the host is there, by the way? Almost no one, right? And then let's say you are okay with that. You can only have two guests. So who's going to use this? They basically made Airbnb obsolete here. The stupidest thing ever. They're just crushing Airbnb in the city for no reason other than they want the hotels to do well. Oh, the hotels. We must protect the hotels. The holy grail. The hotels. The hotels, man. Who cares about the hotels? Let the hotels fend for themselves. The hotels are so great, people are going to want to go there, right? Free market. So stupid. Small landlords say the law unfairly targets people who try to list their homes for rent while out of town, and smaller landlords who want to occasionally rent one apartment on a short-term basis. All right, folks, that is the end of this article, the end of this episode. I hope you've enjoyed this. I'm going to try to do more trending news type stuff with you guys. Love to know your thoughts and comments. Give me a thumbs up on this episode if you will. If you haven't rated our podcast, do that as well. Love you guys, and we will see you on the next episode.